right, and right now I am going to speak about a book, and I'm going to speak with the book's author. And this book is called Othello's. This book is called Othello's Children in the New World, and the author is Dr. Jose Pimenta Bay, and he received a BA in history from Gettysburg College, an MA in history from Shippenburg University, and a PhD in African American Studies from Temple University. And Dr. Pimenta Bay teaches at Berea College, where he serves as a tenured associate professor of African and African American Studies. So are you there, Professor? Oh, long
way. It's a little hard to hear you.
I'm sorry. Are you there? Can you hear me now?
Yes, that's much better.
That's great. So, Professor, what is this book, Othello's Children in the New World? What is it about?
Basically, the book was an attempt to clear up some of the confusion regarding two things.
Mm-hmm.
One is the significance within African American history of the Moorish Science Temple and the Moorish Science Temple movement. And the second thing was to clear up the confusion regarding the Moorish identity. Who are, who were the Moors historically within Western history and within world history in general? So that was the primary focus. And essentially what the book seeks to do is to not so much address the founder, the person responsible for creating the Moorish Science Temple, whose name was Timothy Drew, who later became known as Noble Drew Ali, but rather to historically critique what he was saying via the Moorish Science Temple organization and literature. So essentially that's what an overview of what the book seeks to address.
So where does the title come in when we talk about the book? What relevance does that have?
The relevance is that most people, especially within, I'd say, the Western world and especially in the United States, if they've heard any reference at all to Moor or Moors, they always think of Shakespeare's Othello. So part of it was the idea of identifying, you know, a term by virtue of its literary awareness. In other words, people tend to be more aware of, you know, the Moors in terms of, oh, Othello, wasn't he a Moor? But then they usually couldn't tell you much beyond that.
Right.
But the second thing that I think is far more important is looking at the relevance of Othello as critique by the scholar Jan Carew, who actually talks about Othello as an African man disconnected from his African roots because of his having relocated to the Venetian city-state and is working for the Venetian authorities, and essentially, to some extent, lost his cultural mind and his viewpoint of the world, worldview, I should say, his worldview as an African man. And one of the things that comes out when anyone looks at the legacy of African peoples within the Americas or the Western world is that struggle to retain our cultural identity as we become more assimilated into the Western world. And, you know, there are benefits, clearly, you know, so I'm not criticizing the idea of absorbing, like Bruce Lee used to say, you know, in martial arts, absorb what is useful. But I'm talking about beginning to see yourself as less than a person because of your Africanity and because others who are European are deemed more valuable. And so my contention is that most Black Americans, historically speaking, were as Othello's children, confused. Confused about their identity and, you know, where their loyalties should lie or where their values should be drawn from, all of that. And so Othello's Children is used metaphor for this idea of African peoples not really being comfortable with our African selves because of the lack of self-knowledge or because of the disconnect from our land, from our history and values.
So in this book, what set of, is there any specific confusions that you would, that you want to set straight, or
Absolutely.
There's things, you want to name a couple of things that you address?
I think the first thing, of course, is to understand that the terms Negro, Black, and Colored don't say anything about who we are. It only says something about our state of oppression and our renaming via the nomenclature of the Western world. People from China or Japan or Korea are never known as yellows. We don't refer to them as yellows or you know, yellow Americans. They're known by their nationalities, or they're known at least by being referred to as Asian.
Right.
And I think there's something to be said for having a struggle for some 200 years, even you know, back in the 19th century. People like Martin Delaney, who were talking about this need for nationality, you know, one of the struggles is, you know, who are we? And one would say, well, you know, we're struggling to be recognized as U.S. citizens. Well, that's fine. You struggle to be a U.S. citizen. But what is your nationality? Hmm. What is your pre-U.S. connection? And what emerges by looking at the region of Africa that most Africans who were taken via the asiento, the enslavement trade, to the Americas, fell within a territory that was part of recognized Moorish imperial boundaries. So one of the things that comes out is this revisiting of, well, what would be the proper designation for many of the people who were brought here? Now, we know, of course, we can talk about different ethnic groups, you know, people coming from countries like Ghana or areas within what would become later Liberia or Sierra Leone, et cetera. But the idea of having a nationality was what Drew Ali sought to instill by telling folks there were and there are Moors who had settled in the pre-Columbian Americas, and that there was a treaty agreement between the U.S. And the Moorish Empire, and even the Moorish Empire and the British and the French, and that people known, recognized as Moorish nationals, were legally not to be enslaved. And there are legal cases that reveal this. Hmm. Part of the problem, though, is that people assume that to be a Moor is to be an Arab, number one, that Moor and Arab are synonymous, which they are not.
Right.
And then the second thing is that to be a Moor, you have to be from what is presently the country of Morocco. Morocco was a small portion of what was once Moorish territories. And so those are the types of things that I address and within the book.
Okay. And when individuals read this book, what do you want them to get out of it?
I want them to see a wider picture of the African person's role in world history, but certainly within Western history. And I want them to also see the importance of paying attention to nomenclature, the terms that we use for each other, not just because it's relevant for legal reasons, but because it's relevant for, there's a field of something called neurolinguistics, which also relates to psychology, that by recognizing that words have power, as well as, you know, our history, knowing who we are and our connection to our ancestors, that's something which will transform how we engage other people and how we engage ourselves. It begins to make us more noble, as the term, of course, would be for anyone within the Moorish community. It begins to manifest, you know, the traits, the ideals of love, truth, peace, freedom, and justice. We're seeking to set an example for the human family of what it is to be decent human beings. And I think part of that comes from knowing who we are.
Right.
And that legacy is generally lost. We don't, as African peoples, usually understand our connection to areas of the sciences and the establishment of the university system within the Western world. And this is something that had a tremendous amount to do with the Moors, who were African Muslims.
So all Moors are Africans, and all Africans are Moors? For sure.
Well, definitely all Moors would be of traceable African ancestry, historically speaking.
Right.
The problem is that because terms will change with different centuries and obviously different locales, and that has more to do, I argue, with a lack of the historical awareness of what was actually transpiring. So people would then say, well, no, Moor is only a reference to people who are Arabs, or to be a Moor, you have to be from Morocco. But again, if we're looking at this historically, if we're addressing 18th century America, and the term Moor was understood to be a reference to someone who was of African ancestry, both in British coats of arms, Dutch history, French, British, etc., then we have to say, well, wait a minute, what happened? How do we go from being Moors to being Negroes? Or how do we go from being Moors to being Blacks? And so it's complicated.
Right.
And the complexity is what often has prevented people from even trying to address it. And to the credit of someone like Noble Drew Ali, that's what he sought to do in the early 1920s. And helping to tell that story is what I hope my work does.
Okay. And I see that a lot of the other books that you've written, a lot of it is, I'm sure, Afrocentric in a lot of ways. And so why do you think these topics are relevant? And why do you want to keep speaking about them?
For the reason you just mentioned, that, to be Africa-centered or Afrocentric is to seek to see the world through your own eyes.
Right.
If we can't see the world through our own eyes, we're never really seeing ourselves for who we are, and we're never going to be able to resolve the difficulties we have. So, one of my professors, my mentors, was, or I should say is, because he hasn't stopped, really, Dr. Malefi Asante from Temple University, and, of course, the late, great Dr. Ivan Van Sertima, who I worked with on the book The Golden Age of the Moor.
Right.
And there was always this importance, not saying, well, how do we see things, how do we present historical information from the perspective of the African people themselves, or if we were doing a Native American work, how do you see it from the perspective of the indigenous peoples of the Americas? That's vital. And so many histories have often, not done that. And I think now there's more of a tendency to do that. But I would say that it's because of the Afrocentric movement that came out, particularly in the late 80s and through the 90s.
All right. And as we wrap up this interview, Doctor, let the people know, why is it essential for them to come out next week and come and see you and participate in your lecture and book signing?
Well, I would say it's essential if people want to know more about, again, the African experience,
right?
And I would even venture to say the human experience. We live in a world that's increasingly shrinking, and what I mean by that is we're more conscious of the fact that we're kind of, as they say, pushing elbows. And as we come into closer quarters, I think it's better to recognize the role that others have played in advancing human civilization. And so little, like I said before, so little is known about the profound impact of African people on the establishment even of the United States, the settlements in the pre-Columbian Americas, the connections to the founding of the university system in Europe. All of that are things that I'll end up touching upon, and things that I also address in my book. So I try to touch some vital areas to really raise the level of consciousness and historical literacy, as I often put it, within the African world.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Doctor.
Thank you for inviting me on. I look forward to seeing people out next week.
Yeah, and they will be there. I'm sure they will be. Thank you again.
Okay, thank you, sister.
Bye. And that's Jose Pimenta Bay, and he'll be here July 23rd, and he'll be at 758 Bathurst Street, and that's south of Bloor. And he'll be doing a book signing from 3 to 4:30 p.m. and a lecture from 5 to 7. So definitely check him out, and he'll be here again next week, Saturday. And his book is called Othello's Children in the New World.